yourselves.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Did the leadership of one big Northwest city decide to deliberately sabotage a Christian group's rally and then condemn them as being the proximate cause of a near riot that happened afterwards, where more than 20 people were arrested, not from the Christian group, but from the groups who were attacking the Christian groups that were supported by the mayor of the city of Seattle, Bruce Harrell, who condemned the Christian group, suggesting that they had provoked what had happened. Well, I thought we've got to talk to Pastor Russ Johnson. I guess you go by Russ, don't you?
Yeah, whatever works.
Hey, Pastor, I always like to tell my audience if I have a dog in the fight. In this case, I've got a man on the cross. I'm a Protestant Christian and proud of it. And so, if I've got a bias in favor of Christians and their work to try to bring about good things in our world, so be it. And I'm willing to take naysayers, but I want you to tell me what happened on Saturday in Seattle.
Yeah, well, there was a worship event that was planned with a multitude of churches that were involved for Saturday of last week, and it was kind of orchestrated as a family day. There were free bike giveaways, free haircuts, face painting, things of that nature, and it was followed by some Christian worship music and some people on the lawn there in Cal Anderson Park worshiping the Lord. And everything was going fine until it wasn't. And that was when a couple hundred Antifa members in Black Bloc rolled up and started getting violent, started throwing water balloons filled with urine, started simulating sex acts in front of children, started physically assaulting police members, started pepper spraying people who had gathered to worship God. And at the end of the day, 23 Antifa members were arrested. Some SPD officers were hospitalized. And several of our people who attended the rally left with various bumps and bruises from being physically assaulted. And unfortunately, Lars, that's kind of par for the course for anybody who has a different opinion in the Seattle region.
I understand that, you know, those of us who are conservatives, who are Christians, might expect to come under attack. In fact, the book says, expect that you're going to come under attack for your faith. So I kind of expect it myself. By the way, I'm talking to Pastor Russell Johnson, Russ Johnson from The Pursuit. But what did you make of it when the mayor of one of America's biggest cities, Bruce Harrell, referred to the organization that put on the rally as a right-wing organization, and that you intended to provoke a reaction by promoting the beliefs that you were promoting in the event?
Yeah, it's obviously completely intellectually dishonest, and the mayor knows that because we released the emails that in fact proved that our team attempted to pull permits multiple times for at least two other locations, and the city said no. And the city itself recommended that we go to Cal Anderson Park. That was their recommendation. And so we followed suit and applied for the necessary permits and received them and held the event in accordance with the permits we received at Cal Anderson Park. And so the mayor must have forgotten that email is a thing, and that has a long shelf life. And so this morning we released those emails that clearly state that Cal Anderson Park was not our idea, It was, in fact, the mayor's idea or his city staff. So this idea that it was this pre-planned, provocative type thing is completely without basis, without merit, completely fabricated. And when he put out that statement, essentially blaming the church for the violence that they encountered, gaslighting people of good faith who were just there to express their constitutionally protected right to worship. And then on top of that, followed it up with a statement saying that in the future, you know, they were going to essentially deny or make it exceedingly difficult for religious groups to pull permits for like-minded events again. We decided that was a bridge too far, and we were going to stand up and draw a line in the sand and hold a rally on the steps of Seattle City Hall and say enough is enough.
You know, even the local newspaper has gotten into this. 22 or 20-plus people arrested among Antifa. Nobody arrested from the group that put on the event or the people who attended the event. And yet the Seattle Times used the terminology of those attacking your group, calling it Fascist Family Day. And they put it in quote marks, even though in the fish wrapper you can't tell who they're quoting. In this case, they're quoting the attackers, as saying the attackers called it a fascist family day. You didn't call that. You called it May Day USA, didn't you?
Yeah, correct. And, you know, of course, then the Seattle Times has the audacity to reach out to me today to ask for an interview, which obviously we turned down. The Seattle Times is the only thing that is potentially in more disrepair than the city of Seattle itself. So they're just not worth the time. But the mainstream media, in specific, the Times and other similar kind of journalistic endeavors, it totally missed the boat on this. But it's because they have an ideological bias towards these radical leftist groups. I mean, these Antifa folks who have brought untold pain, sorrow, agony, destruction on the city of Seattle from 2020 onward have been completely coddled by the mainstream media and now are receiving political cover from the mayor of the city himself. And on top of that, when, you know, the mayor got confronted with that reality, he was so embarrassed that we brought receipts. He decided to issue a follow-up press statement saying that the only reason he's catching flack is because he is the second black mayor of the city and the first biracial mayor of the city. It's laughable.
Played the race
card. And it feels like an episode of SNL. I mean, it's so just ridiculous on its face. Nobody believes him, and he's losing support by the minute. You know what's so crazy, Lars, is this. When we announced this event, the floodgates opened up. This thing went viral. It's dominated the media market the last 3 days. And about 50% of the people who have reached out to me, who have said that they are attending the event, start their email or their DM this way: I want you to know I'm not a Christian and I'm not particularly conservative, but this is beyond the pale.
Unbelievable. That is Pastor Russ Johnson from The Pursuit Northwest. Pastor Johnson, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Wise words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. The Supreme Court has now added 7 new cases to the next term's docket. Which ones are likely to make big changes in Washington, D.C.? Well, Joshua Thompson is a senior attorney and director at the Pacific Legal Foundation's Equity and Opportunity Practice Group. Joshua, welcome back.
Welcome. Thanks for having me, Lars. Good to be back.
Hey, before we get into these seven cases, are we ever going to get the Supreme Court to actually work a full year? Because they kind of work till the early part of July, and then they take about 3 months off. And even during the regular work year, they handle fewer and fewer cases every year. Am I being unfair in describing the nine justices or eight justices and the one that can't tell if she's a woman or not? Am I being unfair to them?
I do think you're being a little unfair, Lars. Especially in recent years, we've seen the expansion of the court's emergency docket. So things that are requiring sort of pressing decisions by the court do get heard in these intervening months. It's not like the justices are not reachable. But I think it is a fair criticism to say that the court has been taking fewer and fewer cases every year. I do think the court should expand its cert grants. There are certainly a number of cert splits across or circuit splits across the country, a number of important issues that the court should hear. A lot of cases that Pacific Legal Foundation petitions every year. And, it's unfortunate that the docket has been declining in recent years.
Well, I mean, only because there are nine of them, and correct me if I'm wrong, they hear fewer cases today than they would have heard, say, 10, 20, 30 years ago. They've got clerks. They've got electronic assistants, and I'm not talking about AI. God forbid we end up with AI changing the rulings of the Supreme Court. But they have all these additional tools to get things done, and yet they're hearing fewer and fewer cases, and that kind of gets under my skin.
Yeah, agreed. There is ample desire from I think government and public plaintiffs to have clarity on issues that are plaguing the country, and the Supreme Court can give that clarity. And the fact that they are not taking as many cases as they did, I mean, you don't have to go back that far. Even the 80s, I think they were taking up to 100 cases a year. And if you go back further, it's in the hundreds. Now we're down to about 60 and maybe a few on the emergency docket. It's a significant decrease in the number of cases that the court's taking each year.
So they're doing about one a week. Wow, what a workload. So let's get to the seven cases they just added, which I take it are going to be actually heard starting when they restart first Monday in October. What's the most interesting and the most consequential of the bunch?
Well, I must plead a little bit to you, Lars, that I was prepared to talk about the cases that were just decided last week, but
okay.
I do have a little bit of knowledge on some of the cases that were granted. The one that's most interesting to me is there was a case that was heard this past term, and it deals with whether race-based districting under what's called Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So individuals or states can bring these claims that certain voting rules are violating the Voting Rights Act because they're discriminatory. And the court heard that case and ended up punting and not deciding it, because sort of coming up next term is a case that calls into the question the very constitutionality of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. So the court punted on sort of the narrow issue of whether Louisiana was violating Section 2, because I think it's signaling this entire idea that the Voting Rights Act can require states to district on the basis of race may be called into question itself.
Well, you think? Because Joshua, look, I'm not a lawyer. I always confess that to my audience. But what they're saying is not, I mean, I would think of classical discrimination would be a black man or a brown man walks into the elections headquarters, says, I want to sign up to vote. And they say, no, you're brown. You can't be signed up. Or no, you can't have a ballot. Or no, you can't cast a ballot. In this case, are they simply saying, it appears that based on what we would expect to happen in a district didn't happen in a district? I remember one in the last few years where they deliberately made a district predominantly Hispanic because the Democrats who were doing the redistricting said, we will get a Hispanic representative out of that. And they didn't. A predominantly Hispanic district elected the white candidate instead of the brown candidate. And they said, well, that's not the way it's supposed to work. Is that what they're zeroing in on, saying, well, that must be discriminatory because you have to make a mostly brown district and then they'll elect brown members to Congress? That's racist thinking in itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. The standard that courts have developed for determining whether there's a violation of the Voting Rights Act is whether you think minority candidates have the ability to elect a candidate of their choice. So even that framing, the idea that think that all minority individuals think alike and they have their own unique candidate of choice, as opposed to every individual may view things differently. The very idea that that minorities need to think in lockstep with one another and elect their candidate of choice, I think, is anathema to the Equal Protection Clause, which requires the law to treat individuals as individuals. So the fact that the court is going to go in and really question whether we should be doing this, you know, divvying up by race, this sordid business of trying to figure out what is the proper race of somebody that should be elected is ridiculous. And I'm glad to see that the court, I think, is going to rein in this abuse of the Equal Protection Clause.
I mean, Joshua, are you ever allowed to walk in front of the justices and say, hey, recently we saw a predominantly white country that chose a black president? Is that allowed to be made? Can you use that as an argument? Say, seems to me that, you know, and I wasn't one of the ones who voted for him because I didn't like his policies, but I didn't vote against him because he was black and a predominantly white country did elect him.
Of course you can. I think that, I mean, look, I don't think it means that racism has been eradicated in America, but it also doesn't mean that we should have a government that is picking and choosing winners on the basis of race. We as a free people and free individuals can make our electoral choices. We've elected an African-American man. We've, you know, South Carolina has elected an African-American senator. We've elected women. And the idea that we should be making rules that tell groups that they have to vote alike and think alike in order to satisfy the Voting Rights Act is ridiculous.
Okay, I've got about a minute. What's the other high point case that's already been decided?
Well, of course, there's the nationwide injunction decision that everybody's been talking about that was decided just last week, and the court reined in a practice that had exploded in recent years, where district court judges with one sort of plaintiff coming before them to fault nationwide policy. It's happened under Republican and Democratic administrations, and the Supreme Court put a stop to that last week.
Now, does that mean that in this case that those lower court judges are going to listen to the Supreme Court and say, oh, okay, we got over our skis, we'll back up? Or are they just going to be obstreperous and say, we don't care what the Supreme Court says? What's your take on that?
I think what it means is that they don't have the power to ignore. Essentially, they don't have that tool in their toolbox anymore. Even if they disagree with the Supreme Court, even if they would like to enjoin a policy of Trump or Biden, depending on who the district court judge is, they don't have that tool in their toolbox anymore. They can only bind the plaintiffs that are before the court and not an entire nationwide policy.
Well, I'm glad they went that way. That's Joshua Thompson from the Pacific Legal Foundation's Equality and Opportunity Practice Group. Joshua, thanks very much. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. So tell Alexa to play The Lars Larson Show and check me out on Instagram.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I want to talk about Portland specifically right here. We often talk about other parts of the Northwest like Spokane and Seattle. But Jeff Heger joins me now, who's a former mayor of Bend, attorney, political consultant, and you can read what he writes at Oregon Roundup on Substack. Jeff, I want you to tell my audience what they should make of the fact that we have, and I'll give you a couple of data points, the biggest tax increase in state history, billions of dollars, that the current legislature, all dominated by Democrats, are going to pass because government has to have more money even though the citizens are suffering. You've got state lawmakers on the left side of the aisle who are saying, anybody who opposes taxes, you're just acting like petulant children, not willing to do what the state has demanded that you do. And now you've got a governor in Kotek who's literally said to her biggest, you know, basically base of voters, which is Multnomah County, your taxes are too high. You're scaring away all the millionaires. What should we make of that whole mess?
I think what we should make of it, Lars, is that the Democrats are they're getting fractured, quite honestly. I think that their whole approach to governing the state of Oregon is based on an ever-increasing flow of money to Salem, taxpayer dollars, fee dollars, so that the public sector unions get more money and then can turn those into campaign contributions to the Democrats, who then raise more taxes. That's what the whole scheme is in Oregon, Washington, and California, frankly. But I think that the evidence that some of these taxes, including the preschool for all tax in Portland, is driving away the very taxpayers that Democrats and the unions need to keep their scheme going, is getting through. And that's where you see Kotek making this statement about the preschool tax.
Well, and in fact, haven't they seen enough examples, not just in the United States, I mean, places like California that are seeing an outflow of some of the most creative and some of the richest people are simply saying, I'm done with this. I'm sick of being abused. There are countries that have done this. I think Norway, Sweden, and France are good examples. The UK may be next. And they have all said, let's tax the daylights out of rich people. And the rich people leave. And then they act confused, as though, what will it take to buy a clue for somebody? And maybe Tina Kotek is finally getting a small clue, but not nearly enough if all she's complaining about is the preschool for all tax.
Well, I totally agree, Lars. And, you know, where all that comes from is just their ideology is based on, regardless of outcomes, that they need to maximize the wealth and power of the state. And do whatever is necessary to take that wealth and power from individual citizens and businesses and groups out in society to enrich government. And the consequences are not particularly relevant to them until, you know, in cases like this, where it becomes so bad that someone told Kotek probably that, hey, we're not going to be able to raise any revenue for the stuff we want to raise revenue for if we keep driving all these folks out of the state. But obviously the rest of the people in the party haven't gotten that message yet.
Well, but the next step, if you follow the same pattern that they did about 100 years ago with the income taxes, you say, we're going to have a tax, but it's only on the really rich, rich, rich folks. And then people who are not rich, rich, rich go to the polls and say, hey, that'd be great. Make them pay for free daycare for us, which is what preschool for all us. It has almost no relevance to education. And if you don't believe me, contact the Northwest Education Center, which is not a conservative organization, gathers all the studies they've ever done on what used to be called Head Start, and it doesn't make a damn bit of difference by the time the kid's in second grade whether they were in Head Start or not. But it is an excuse to employ a lot of people at high salaries and provide a lot of jobs that then provide union dues that provide the Democrats with what they need. It's like everything connects back to what does it take to feed the Democrat machine? And they're doing it. Now, whether it does any good for the people, and then you get colossally stupid decisions, and I'd like you to comment on those. City of Portland settles a lawsuit that probably never should have been brought by people who said, my granddad got cheated out of his house by eminent domain, and they agreed to settle for $2 million. And the city council says, why don't we give you $8.5 million? And I'm not even joking about that. They had a settlement at $2 million, and they said, we'll give you $8.5 million instead. And then you've got a colossally expensive water filtration plant at $2 billion, or about six times what it originally was forecast to cost about 6 years ago, and that's stupid. And you got a bridge they can't seem to build across the Columbia River, and that thing keeps getting more expensive. And these are the decisions we're getting out of the people who say we need more, more, more of your money. I don't get it.
Well, it goes to their priorities, Lars. You know, people want a decent bridge across the Columbia. People want functioning schools. People want, you know, homelessness cleaned up. That's what people want. Those are the effects on the ground that Oregonians and other people on the West Coast want to see happen. But they don't coincide with the goals of the folks who run these states, and I would say especially Oregon, where their stated goal is to create an equitable society, to remake society in their eyes as equitable. And we all know that that doesn't mean equal. That means something quite different than equal. And so they spend their money accordingly. And it's not a surprise that at the end of the day, taxpayers don't get any bang for their buck out of these state governments, because the state governments simply don't prioritize the same thing taxpayers do.
So how do we fix it? You got any ideas? You're a former mayor. You're an attorney. You should have some good ideas, right?
Well, people have to vote differently, right? People have to start electing people that Don't buy into that ideology that view, you know, people's money, individuals' money, businesses' money as their money first and foremost. And it is only under extreme circumstances where you take more of that money from them, that it's their money to begin with, and the state needs a really good reason to take any of it, let alone more of it, and it needs to use it as efficiently as possible.
You know, I got to tell you, Jeff, I ran into one this week that just kind of floored me, and it's a relatively small deal. It's $800,000, which in government is like a rounding error. But I saw it was one of the things that Multnomah County, you know, this county with over a $4 billion budget in a city with a $8.5 billion budget. Do you know they ran their own passport office?
No.
And I'm not kidding. And I said to somebody, I said, when you think of passport, what do you think of? You go, post office. I mean, there's no U.S. embassy located in Portland or Seattle. So you say, well, go to the post office. I can get it done there. There are tons of private companies that will expedite it if you really need a passport right now because you got some trip you hadn't planned on. I haven't renewed. Mine is coming up for renewal. But I thought Multnomah County is the last place I would think of to renew my passport. I mean, I guess any government can do it. But the post office routinely does it. Most federal offices will help you with it. Your congressman's office will help you with it. And you say, so why is the county spending $850,000 a year to run a passport office? And I think the answer is because they can, number one, and number two, because it probably provides some employment. I'm willing to bet that most of the $850,000 they blew on that was, you know, for personnel, maybe a little bit for office space and furniture and all that. But $850,000 a year to provide a service that's offered in lots and lots of other places. And I, for the life of me, cannot understand the connection between the U.S. State Department, which actually issues the passports, and Multnomah County, Oregon. I don't get it.
Yeah, it's just a lack of focus, right? The Multnomah County does a lot of things really poorly. But I think that's an outgrowth of the fact that the people who run Multnomah County and run the state of Oregon, the spending is the point. It's not the outcome that's the point. It's the spending so that they probably can go around in Multnomah County and say, look, we are providing especially equitable passport renewal services to the people who live in Multnomah County, even though those services could be provided quite well by someone else who's already doing it.
And Jeff, I think you said the key word. Do you imagine they have any problem defining yourself by a different pronoun if you go to the Multnomah County Passport Office as opposed to some other passport office? That is Jeff Eager. You can read what he writes at Oregon Roundup on Substack.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Summer.
He does the work so you don't have to. Bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I love it when I wake up in the morning and I see something, and usually it's about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I take a look at some of the wires and what's gone on overnight, and it didn't happen at 5 o'clock. The Supreme Court doesn't get up that early, but they did issue a decision, and I thought it was a great decision because the folks in Tennessee have a sensible legislature that passed a law saying you doctors are not allowed in the state of Tennessee to genitally mutilate teenage kids. You're just not allowed to do it. Not just teenagers, all kids. Now that's great. 24 other states have similar laws, and now the Supreme Court has said Tennessee and effectively the other states are allowed to do exactly that. So I thought I'd check in with our Memphis affiliate, and that's KWAM, KWAM. And Steve Gill is from Wake Up Memphis, which is our affiliate station there. And since he's with the Wake Up Show, I would imagine that Steve is probably only a couple of hours away from bedtime. So, Steve, I appreciate you taking the time tonight to celebrate this great win. But is it being viewed that way in Memphis?
Lars, thanks so much for having me. And I also am a lawyer, so I have my lawyer hat on as well. And this is great victory for kids across the state of Tennessee. And as you mentioned, 24 other states, if they will follow the Tennessee law, they'll be able to know that they have the affirmation of the Supreme Court that one will pass constitutional muster. You know, I'm just thrilled that when I was a kid and was 5 years old and wanted to be a pirate, that my parents didn't cut off one leg, poke out my eye, and give me a parrot like these guys would want to do at Vanderbilt Medical Center. Now, I would have liked the parrot, but I'd be regretting the loss of leg and an eye right now, even though running around saying "R" a lot would still be fun.
Well, and Steve, I got to ask you this. On the day that they issued the Obergefell decision, even though, and that's the gay marriage decision, there were all these states that had already voted saying, no, we've looked at it, we don't want gay marriage. And yet immediately, the left immediately said, now, it is the law of the land, it must be imposed. And there were county clerks all over America saying, I didn't agree with the decision, but there it is. They said, we're going to immediately start handing out licenses for gay people to get married. Now, whatever you think about that issue, that was the effect. Do you think we're going to see a similar effect where major medical institutions like, say, Vanderbilt are going to say, okay, we got the word from the guys on the court and the gals on the court, no more transgender surgeries, no more hormone treatments for kids, or are they going to either slow walk or even try to just simply ignore this decision?
I think that's a risk, and it's not just the Obergefell decision that you mentioned, but when the Supreme Court rules that Second Amendment rights are an individual right, you still have places, New York, Washington, D.C., Chicago, that are banning guns and not following the Supreme Court declarations. So again, the left will try to fight back or delay or just ignore the orders of the Supreme Court if it doesn't go their way. The good thing is that we have a very conservative, one of the best attorney generals in the country, in Jonathan Scrimeti, who defended this before the Supreme Court, won in a 6-3 decision. The tragic thing here, Lars, is we had six good Supreme Court justices say this is just wrong, but you still have three liberal Supreme Court justices who see nothing wrong with this transfiguration abuse of children. So that's a warning signal that the left is still way whacked out. But we've got about 25 to 26 Republican attorney generals across the country. Most of those states that will embrace the Tennessee law are in those states, and you're going to have attorney generals who will maybe make sure that if states follow the Tennessee lead on this issue, they'll be going after medical centers.
I guess
they'll
be
going after doctors.
What I'm worried about, Steve, is most of the time when the Supreme Court comes down with a decision, there's at least some way to visually see whether there is compliance. I mean, in Brown versus the Board of Education, you said, yep, those brown kids have a right to go to school with the white kids. You can't block them. You can actually go and see the effect of that. I wasn't alive at the time, but I can imagine standing there and watching kids go to school together with other kids of other races. Good. That was the decision. But in this kind of decision, the victims of this transgender nonsense, this surgical and chemical sterilization and castration of kids, can't be seen. And usually the kids are not in a position to complain, nor are their parents likely to complain. So how do we make sure that these medical centers are actually doing what the Supreme Court has ordered?
Well, I think scrutiny and making sure that we are watching to make sure the law is being enforced. But the real sick thing here, Lars, is that you have parents who are complicit in this. They're not doing this to kids without them knowing. They're bringing their 4-year-old, 5-year-old saying, oh, I've decided my kid's transgender. It's parents that have been so caught up in this woke, sick agenda that are actually promoting this, authorizing it. But at least in Tennessee, it's going to be a lot more difficult to find doctors that will violate the Hippocratic Oath of do no harm when they're being told this is harm.
I'm talking to Steve Gill. He's from Wake Up Memphis on our affiliate station in Memphis, and that's KWEM, the Mighty 990. So let me ask you this. Will the state authorities now view this as abuse of these children and say to the parents, look, if you try to do this, if you go out and try and get this kind of care for your kid, we're going to consider it abuse? Or do you have that kind of state government?
Well, and will they prosecute doctors that still go ahead and do this? And I think that's a real question.
Well, you know what, Steve? America has now laid it out. States can ban it. Half the states, 25 of them, have banned it. Most of Europe, Western Europe at least, has banned it. And the medical community has finally admitted, we don't have a scientific basis for all this Mengele stuff we've been doing to these kids. So with all of that, you would think that at some point the light bulb would turn on. Steve, thanks very much. That's Steve Gill from our Memphis affiliate, KWEM. Steve, we appreciate you coming on the show.
Lars Larson Show. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on this Tuesday, live on the Radio Northwest Network, and glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, I'd love to have somebody call in and say, oh, I just can't wait for the legislature to pass that new almost $2 billion a year tax increase just to keep ODOT paying its bills and keeping the lights turned on. I'd love to hear the naysayer who's in favor of that. Apparently, Democrats in Salem believe that this is what the people of the state of Oregon want. Now, I think it's what the bureaucracy of the state of Oregon wants. And to give us another perspective from outside the chamber, former state lawmaker Jeff Krupp joins me now. Jeff, welcome back.
Hey, friend, always good to be with you on a beautiful summer day.
It is a beautiful day. It's summer. It's officially summer, although it rained on the first day of summer. But tell me this. As a former lawmaker, there is a way for Republicans to actually tell the Democrats no on this tax increase, isn't there?
Absolutely. What they do is they walk out and shut down the rest of the legislative session. They walk out en masse, deny quorum, whether it's on the House side or the Senate side. This bill's in the House. It's House Bill 2025. So, you know, that the House Republicans need to step up here. And my kudos to all of them, by the way, including Christine Drazen and Court Boyce, who you just had on, for walking out yesterday. Glad they did that. But unfortunately, there were other members who stayed. That allows the Democrats to keep doing business, keep passing other bad bills. But with this bill, which will dramatically raise the cost of living directly and indirectly to everybody who lives in Oregon, this bill, Republicans need to walk out, shut the session down, then negotiate their way back in the building. And it's a strategy that works, Lars, because Herman Bertziger did it when he was the Republican leader in the Oregon Senate years ago on cap and trade. That's how you stop it, because then Republicans have leverage, because the budget bills aren't done. So the Democrats want to give their union members their pay so they can get their dues and put it back in the hands of the Democrat lawmakers with campaign contributions. So they don't want the state to shut down. They got to finish the budget. So Republicans have the leverage of the budgets and just say, you know what, we're not going to do anything else unless you agree to only finish with the budgets. And if they don't want to do that, the Republicans can shut the session down. It can end, as the Constitution says, Sunday night at midnight on the 29th. Then the governor can call a special session, but Republicans don't have to show up. And it doesn't get counted against them under Measure 113.
Measure 113 is the one that punishes you if you walk out and deny quorum, right? If an unexcused absence, right?
Correct.
Okay, but it doesn't.
You negotiate,
hold on,
Lars,
Jeff, just so people
into the building.
Yeah, but just so people understand why, if the governor calls a special session and the, you know, the Democrats all show up, but the Republicans don't show up, so the session is never gaveled into existence, then you can't be punished for not showing up for a meeting that never officially started. Is that the gist of it?
Absolutely. Republicans are in the driver's seat here. Now, the question is, Lars, will they do it? They need to do it. Will they? And I get to your caller who called from the Grants Pass area. You know, Dwayne Junker walked out yesterday. He's very conservative. My guess is he walks out no matter what happens. And I think Noah Robbins does also. But the House Republicans need to step up here, and they all need to take a stand, Lars.
Now, why weren't they walking out yesterday, the ones that didn't walk?
You know, I honestly don't know. I think some of them are angling to get pork for their district. I think there are others that have altruistic reasons that just believe you should stay there and just take it. No matter how badly your constituents and the state gets hurt, you swore an office to serve So you come and you serve and you let the Democrats roll over you, and that's a mistaken notion. But there are some Republicans who I really believe think that way, Lars. It's crazy.
I don't understand, though, but if you, by showing up, give the Democrats the power to vote the tax increases through, and you know that's what your constituents don't want, and you say, well, but I got elected to show up here, so I'm just going to show up, sit in my seat. My vote doesn't mean a damn thing because the Democrats have these majorities in both houses. And so I'm just going to stay here and enable the Democrats to pass tax increases that your own constituents have said loud and clear they don't want.
That's the part that doesn't make any sense. I have to tell you, in the 8 years I served in the House, we were in the majority. I was never in this place. However, the Democrats walked out on us and shut down our legislative session. Now, I got to tell you, it's an extreme thing to do, but it's the right thing to do when your constituents' families are going to be hurt so bad by House Bill 2025, hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars more per year they're going to be paying out of their pocket for no good reason other than, as Nigel Jaquist put it in his Willamette Week piece yesterday, to backfill the operating losses and the malfeasance of incompetent ODOT leadership.
Yeah, I was going to get to ODOT because I want to ask you this. How does ODOT justify in any way being so incompetent with all this money, taking all $3 billion every year, $6 billion, I think it's $6 billion per biennium, and they don't seem to accomplish anything with it? In other words, where are the brand new roads? Where are the brand new bridges? Where are even the well-maintained roads that we drive on? I drive Oregon plenty of times, even though I live in Washington State, and they get all this money and they don't accomplish anything with it. And they go to the legislature and say, we need a couple of billion more.
Yeah, and that's the problem, is that you wouldn't have that happen if you had a governor who had the courage to actually hold people accountable when they screw up the way ODOT screwed up here. Now, there's some great ground-level workers, and you know there are because you run
yes,
into them that listen to your
that.
Show, the rank-and-file people, but it's the leadership that is incompetent. And as long as Tina Kotek, Kate Brown, any other Democrat governor will not fire them and make it public and send the fear of God through the bureaucrats, like you noted early in your comments, this is just going to continue. We stop it if Republicans walk out today, tomorrow, and say it's over until you guys come to your senses.
Do you think that's likely to happen at this point, Jeff? Because I'm skeptical.
Well, I am too, sadly. Maybe in the Senate, because five of those members can't come back because they're subject to Measure 113's removal from running for office again. So they only need five more. And the way Court Boyce made it sound is like the Republicans in the Senate are holding firm on that. Okay, but it should be the Republicans in the House. They're the ones that need to stand firm, come together and say, we cannot do this to families. We can't let a bad gun bill or a couple of bad gun bills get
yep.
passed to put gun dealers out of
business
our
altogether.
Ability. Yeah, out of business.
No, it can't happen. And so the question is, I wonder whether a Kevin Mannix, who has been showing up, is Kevin Mannix going to come on and explain? Because this is a multi-billion dollar issue. It's in front of you now. And if you think this is the last tax increase, no. Tolling is coming right down the pipe.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. He has small town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So this past weekend, Operation Midnight Hammer, massive ordnance penetrators that, according to President Trump, who could have overstated it on Saturday night, but he said that Iran's nuclear program has been, to use his word, obliterated. Now, there are others who are saying, well, you know, we're not entirely sure. They don't know what actually happened 300 feet underground, but it sounds like it was nothing good. So even if part of that program still remains, the fact is Iran is teetering on the edge, at least its ability to make war on other countries. So I thought we'd talk to Trita Parsi about that, who's executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Trita, it's been a while. Welcome back.
It's been a while. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and I want to ask you, can we start with this? Does Iran, under its current leadership of the last 50 years or so, engage in responsible statecraft in any way, shape, or form?
That's a great question. No, I think Iran in many ways has been a negative actor in the region, but I would have to caveat that by saying there's hardly been any responsible actors in that region over the course of the last 40, 50 years, with the exception of a few very small states like Oman and others who have really dedicated themselves to simply try to do conflict resolution.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, what about Egypt? I mean, Egypt sits there next to Israel, and they're not constantly trying to, you know, to take the country down. And they're smart enough to put up a big fence to keep all the people in Gaza from going into Egypt. Isn't that right? And I understand they're under a military government right now, but it seems to be working out reasonably well, doesn't it? Or am I wrong in reading?
Yeah, but I don't know if I would call that. I would define that as being a definition of responsible statecraft. There's much more that could have been wished for by the Arab leadership in general, not just that of Egypt.
So tell me this: how popular is the current government of Iran with the people of Iran?
Oh, I don't think this is a popular government in any way, shape, or form. And we've seen significant protests, particularly back in 2022. And this is a regime that at the end of the day is extremely repressive. It's incompetent in many different areas. It's corrupt. It has mismanaged the economy. Iran was back in 2000, I believe, quite a bit larger than the Turkish economy. I think now the Turkish economy is almost twice the size of Iran, which of course is also a lot to do with economic sanctions, etc. But a lot of it is also because of mismanagement and corruption. I would have to point out, though, that the attacks that Israel has conducted against Iran has, to a large extent, at least in the short run, benefited the Iranian government, because you have the same type of rally around the flag phenomenon there as you have in almost every country, including Israel itself, in which the population rallied around the flag, but not around Netanyahu after the October 7th attacks.
Yep. Well, so is there a possibility, because I don't think our country should get involved in engineering regime change, but what I'm wondering is, will the current circumstances of Iran, where two-thirds of its missile launchers have been knocked out, its nuclear program, as I said, I did put the caveat in there, Trita, to say maybe they've got some shred of their nuclear program left. Maybe it's all at the bottom of a big, deep hole, and they're never going to get it back. But in any case, they seem to have diminished their own power. An awful lot of their top leaders and top scientists have been wiped out. Is this the point where the local population of Iran might just say, it's time for us to take control of our own government? Or is that in the cards?
No, because I think right now, if you're sitting in Iran, your primary concern is not to get bombed by the Israelis. You don't have a lot of phenomenon in which, under circumstances like these, the population would rise up, because the population don't have the means of violence in the same way that the government does. Under these circumstances, in which Israel is attacking Iran and bombing Iran, the more likely scenario, if the regime were to collapse, is not that a bunch of peaceful NGOs and civil society leaders takes over the country, but rather that elements within the same regime that is even more hardline takes control over the country and uses it by through force, because they have access to weaponry, whereas the population does not.
And then at that point, how do they continue to sustain themselves? Because am I right in assuming that the economic starvation of Iran that was going on during Donald Trump's first 4 years is being modeled today, and that they're again being economically starved because they keep supporting the Houthis and Hamas and militias and Hezbollah and shooting missiles at their neighbors? There's no reason for the Trump administration to let Iran continue to benefit from all these oil sales. And I know they're selling bargain basement oil to China, but are they going to be able to keep things going with that?
I think the Trump administration under this administration has intensified those sanctions somewhat, but not to the same level as they did before, for a very simple reason. They would shoot up oil prices for the average American consumer as well. I don't think Trump is interested in doing that right now. So there's been a lot of talk. I think there's been less action. I don't blame him for that. I don't think actually it would be helpful to do it, because I think it would be much, much more helpful. And I think he's much more interested, or should be more interested, in actually securing a deal in which the sanctions would be lifted and American companies could enter the Iranian market and benefit from increased trade and investments in a way that they have not been able to do in the past, partly because of the American sanctions and partly because the Iranians didn't want American companies in their economy back then. But the Iranians have changed their mind on that, at least prior to this 10, 15 days now that there's been this shooting war going on.
Does this change, does the attack this weekend and maybe the elimination of their nuclear program set them up to run the country differently and say, if we stop shooting missiles at our neighbors, if we can't stop the weekly reminders, death to Israel, death to America, that maybe we can just start doing business with the rest of the world and everybody in the country benefits? Or is there religious extremism going to allow that?
No, I don't think so, because I don't think they think that that is the reason why they are under sanctions. And frankly, I don't think that is the reason why they're under sanctions. The Israeli attack on Iran did not precede by Iranian missile attacks against Israel. So the Iranians have been under sanctions for quite some time under circumstances that were very different from these. This is a geopolitical context that is taking place. It's been going on for decades. It is not because of what Iran's slogans at a rally is, or because of things of that nature. This is about much, much more serious stuff. And the Iranians can potentially get out of some of those sanctions if there is a deal that is made. But for that deal to be made, Lars, I have to say, Trump has to go back to his original American red line when he started the negotiations, which was that he wanted to see no weaponization in Iran.
Right.
Halfway through the negotiations, he shifted his red line. This is all public. You can double check it. To no enrichment, which was the Israeli red line, which the Israelis pushed for because they knew that the minute that he shifted to this position, negotiations would start to stall and potentially even collapse, because they didn't want to see a deal between the U.S. and Iran. They wanted to see the United States go into a major military confrontation with Iran. So I hope that the event of the just last 2 hours actually gets the two parties back to the table. But for that negotiation to work, it can't be Trump pushing the Israeli red line, because that red line is designed to get the U.S. into war.
Unbelievable. Trita, thank you very much. That's Trita Parsi, Executive Director at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Your emails are welcome. talk@larslarson.com. And check out my Instagram feed, where you'll find I've got a face for radio.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Unwrapping the news so you don't have to. Back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a crazy, crazy day. The state legislature is still in session, and they're out there searching around for money. Now, they've got a lot of money to spend, but apparently they've decided they need more. Cap and trade is one of the crazy ideas that's being pushed, at the same time that the state legislature is not doing the things in Oregon that might actually head off some of the wildfires that cost literally hundreds of millions of dollars every single year to put out. So, now that we talked to Jennifer Hammaker, who is president of the Oregon Natural Resource Industries. Jennifer, it's been too long since you've been on.
Well, yes, there's a lot that's been happening. This is the cap and trade is, I can't believe it's back.
And why is it back with somebody like Bruce Starr, who's allegedly a Republican, pushing it?
Well, you will not believe what I just found out, and it almost made me cry. Cap and trade is the lesser of the two evils. So you remember, many businesses in Oregon are considering cap and trade. It's a market-based program that will be overseen by the legislature through a transportation bill that was just introduced. You remember cap and trade back in 2019? Okay. When the walkouts happened? Okay, well, we defeated it. But then Kate Brown decided to implement it anyways through an executive order, which directed the DEQ and unelected bureaucrats to create and implement cap and regulate, which is the climate change plan.
Yep.
We call it the CCP. The CCP is the most aggressive, expensive, and punitive plan in the United States.
What would it do? What are the, for lay people not involved in this, what would it do to industry and agriculture?
Oh, my God. It's going to wreck us. So it is in 2028, the second phase of the CCP starts, and it's going to raise everything, anything to do with agriculture, farming, trucking, manufacturing, any kind of business. The CCP is, you know, the Democrats keep passing these policies that drive away business, and that's exactly what the CCP does.
Well, so in fact, isn't it doing the same thing that the Climate Commitment Act is doing Washington State? Where agriculture was supposed to be exempt. It turns out the state bureaucracy was too busy for that. It's costing individuals a lot more money every time they buy fuel at the pumps.
Yep.
And it's costing everybody more money because fuel and petrochemicals are involved in everything we eat and everything that's brought anywhere involving a vehicle like a train or a boat. Or an airplane.
Yeah, exactly. And it, the whole idea behind it is to reduce carbon emissions, which is a bunch of a baloney, because it doesn't. But one of the things that the CCP does, just to put in layman terms so that people can understand it, is like, so the home heating with natural gas, if you have a bill that costs $100 to get that natural gas to heat your home, the compliance fee can be somewhere towards $200 on top of the $100 it costs you to buy that gas. So that would make your bill $300. And that starts in 2028. And that's what the CCP does, just as one example to just the consumer. That doesn't have anything to do with the business or agriculture or anything else like that. The CCP, like I said, is the most expensive and punitive plan in the United States right now. It is absolutely horrible, and I think that's why businesses are considering cap and trade, which is also horrible. I mean, in Oregon, I think the political climate is death by a thousand cuts. That's what they try to do.
Well, just so people understand, you correct me if I'm wrong, Jennifer, cap and trade means you tell industries you're only allowed to produce this much CO2 and you set a limit somewhere. Now you're going to change the limits as the years go on. But if you say if you produce more than that, and they all will, then you have to buy credits to offset that. And it becomes these, you know, where the government is selling you magic beans to make up for the overage in CO2, which I agree with you, CO2 is plant food and there's nothing wrong with it. But they say you have to buy these credits to be able to qualify. It's one of the major money makers for Tesla, among others. They sell credits all day long. But they're going to pull $1 billion in new taxes, and it's going to hit everybody in the state. And they think this is not going to have a real downward effect on the economy and on the ability of people to live here.
Yes, well, and so just so you know, or your listeners know, a credit usually is right around $40 on the open market. Oregon is going to set these in auction at $132 per credit. So, three times as much, and not only that, it's in auction, so they can go up.
So people will make money on buying and selling of credits, and the customers, the consumers, and the businesses will pay the tab.
That's right. It's an artificial market scam that will basically impact our most vulnerable and our businesses and the people of Oregon. Yeah.
So tell me this. I want to go back to Bruce Starr, though. Why is a Republican like Bruce Starr pushing this idea? Just saying, well, it's why not say, instead of saying it's the better of the two bad alternatives, how about this? Does the state of Oregon need another $1 billion out of people's pockets with the kind of revenue they're getting right now?
They think they do. They absolutely think they do. There's so many bad bills going through right now that will raise taxes on so many different things. It's not even funny. One of the bills that's going to be implemented in July is a packaging bill. So anything, your eggs that are packaged, your strawberries that are packaged, anything that you buy that is packaged, they're going to tack on another percentage tax onto that. So all of your consumer goods are going to go up. I mean,
so it's a sales tax.
Yeah.
But they're trying to avoid the prohibition on sales taxes by saying it's a packaging tax, as though you can go somewhere and find eggs for sale that aren't in a cardboard carton?
Correct.
And where is that? Where is that place?
Exactly. Yeah, buy a chicken.
Yeah, buy a chicken. And that's what probably people will do. But it probably will send a lot of businesses running away from the state, a state that's already sending businesses away, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. UVO just came out with an analysis on business analysis, and it shows that, you know, mass exodus of businesses.
So what's the fix? Is there a way to stop this thing, or are the Democrats just going to say, we've got the votes and we're going to pass it and we're going to get some of your Republicans to support it?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that's probably their plan. However, I don't know how they're going to pass cap and trade through this transportation bill by the end of the session, since we're coming up to sign and die. So I'm not sure how that's all going to work out. They might call a special session. They might do it next short session. I have no idea. But what's in front of me right now is the transportation reinvestment plan by Senator Chris Gorsuch and Representative Suzanne McClain, and it's basically cap and trade. And it says in there that they will, instead of using the CCP, the climate change plan, they will use cap and trade instead. And I think that's why some of our Republican representatives and senators are looking at cap and trade and seriously considering it, because it is the lesser of two evils. You know as well as I do that if we decide they decide to go with cap and trade, they're going to implement the CCP anyways. And tolling, and gas taxes, and everything else. Yeah, and then also, I mean, as you know, they just gave the Department of Forestry $218 million for fire mitigation. Where did that money go? I mean, we just started our first major forest fire a week ago, the whole thing is a scam to me. The Oregon legislature, run by the Democrats, are just going to tax people right out of their livelihood.
And maybe that's their intention. Jennifer Hammaker, who is president of Oregon Natural Resources. Jennifer, thanks very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Lars with you all day, every day. Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. You know that Puerto Rico cashes in on billions of dollars from Uncle Sam every year, even though Puerto Rico is not an American state. But does the island really want to sign up as America's 51st state, or is there a different kind of dream on the horizon? Javier Hernandez joins me now, leader of the Prexit movement. Javier, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Thank you for the opportunity.
First of all, tell my audience what Prexit is all about.
Well, Prexit is just a movement for Puerto Rican independence, but it's not just independence. It's having a plan, having strategies, knowing exactly where we want to go and how we're going to do it.
So fully a country and not still tied to the United States the way it is now, or would there still be a link?
No, we would like to have a link. I mean, what we want is sovereignty, independence, but still maintain a positive, great diplomatic and economic relationship with the United States. It's an important world power, obviously. And we've, you know, 127 years with the U.S., we've developed, you know, good relationships, but the colonial relationship is not working, and we want our independence, but yet maintain great relationship with the United States.
Okay, and if, by the way, I will probably neglect if I don't do it now, Javier, tell my audience where to find online more information about the Prexit movement.
Well, I'm pretty much on X, So if you can go to at Prexit Book on Twitter or X, and there you can get all the information on my links.
So hashtag Prexit movement. Let's get to the practical side of this, and that is because Puerto Rico is not a state, but it's also not an entirely independent nation. You've said that they don't control their own trade, tariffs, energy grid, or economic policy. The U.S. controls that?
Yes, everything. The U.S. has plenary total power over Puerto Rico. And obviously, it's not direct. It's not like every little thing is controlled, but the economy, like the major things, our borders, the economy, our airspace, well, the shipping. I mean, those big things are controlled by federal laws and politicians in D.C., not by us in Puerto Rico at all.
Well, and in fact, let me ask you about something, because the Jones Act comes up from time to time on this show at various times. And I think I recall that when Puerto Rico, say, has a major disaster like a hurricane come through, and people say, well, load up a bunch of propane and water and supplies and take it from, say, the port of New Jersey out to Puerto Rico, under the Jones Act, unless they get a presidential exception, American law actually forbids American ships, unless they're, what, made in America, crewed in America, and flagged in America, they can't go to Puerto Rico, can they?
Exactly. So there are many foreign ships that are crewed, that are, you know, like under the U.S. flag, but they can't come to Puerto Rico. We can only get Jones Act approved ships, which limits it and increases the value of everything that's imported into Puerto Rico, because it has to be Jones Act ships.
So if you were your own independent nation, that wouldn't be true anymore. In fact, Javier, I'm sure you've thought of this, but it occurred to me, if you get on a cruise ship, it has to sort of touch base in a foreign place, which is why a lot of times on the left coast where I live, if you got on a cruise ship in Seattle and you want to go to, say, Alaska, you've got to do a stop off in Vancouver, which works out pretty well anyway. But if you could actually have American cruise ships that could call on Puerto Rico, although you do now, but I'm just not sure how that works. So would that change as well?
Yes. With sovereignty, we could actually treat our own shipping. We can create our own shipping companies, or we can actually contract with American shipping like Crowley and others, because they have international fleets that aren't Jones Act. So we can even contract with them or with foreign shippers. Or as I said, we could develop our own shipping industry. Right now, we're hamstrung. We cannot do anything but use Jones Act shipping, and they're limited, they're expensive, and they're the only ones we could use. So we're not benefiting from it. Yeah.
So, Javier, who has to say yes for this to happen, and do the people of Puerto Rico want it?
That's the big question. So we've been trying to get our independence for over 100 years, first with Spain and then from the United States. And the main thing is that, you know, when they talk about this is, We're not American. We were invaded, we're occupied, and for many decades, they even tried to turn us into Americans. Assimilation policies enforced and English only, and they all failed in Puerto Rico. It didn't work, it all failed. We're really proud of our nation, our culture, our identity. So assimilation failed. Even today, people don't want to assimilate, you know, and statehood is really about money. You know, like you'd expect statehooders to be more about American patriotism and be part of the U.S., but they're not. The vast majority, it's all about getting more money, more welfare money.
Oh, geez.
And, but that's the issue. In D.C., in front of Americans and in Congress people, the statehood advocates are very, they know the narrative. They know what to say to pull on your heartstrings. Our men and women fought in uniform and all that. But then in Puerto Rico, it's all about, hey, let's get statehood so we can get more gringo money, $10 billion more gringo money. That's literally how they say it. And I'm against that. I want us to create our own economy, our own production, our own wealth. And we shouldn't be, you know, just dependent on the U.S. Like that. Just basically independence would be a win-win for Puerto Rico and the U.S.
Certainly sounds like it to me. Javier, we're going to look forward to having you back. I really appreciate it. I'll encourage people to check out hashtag Prexit, the Prexit movement to gain nationhood for Lars.
15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the
Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, I don't want to let an opportunity go by to actually say that maybe a major league Democrat politician in the Northwest actually got one right for a change, because I'm frequently critical of the likes of Bob Ferguson and Tina Kotek, the governors respectively of Washington and Oregon. So, Jim Manley is going to join me. He's state policy chief at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tell me this. You think Governor Tina Kotek got it right by signing a new law into place that might actually increase the amount of housing being built?
It's a weird moment we're in. There's bipartisan agreement on the fact that we need more housing. And I think the governor recognized that and signed this bill last night to expand housing in Oregon.
I guess I'm just worried that when I see Senate Bill, just so everybody's, there are people who ask, Senate Bill 974, that streamlines residential development permitting and addresses the state's housing crisis. Sometimes when I see the words reform or streamline, I think, oh, well, how does it actually change it? Does it actually make a big enough difference that it will draw in people to build more housing? Or is this just taking a mountain of paperwork and turning it into a very, very tall hill of paperwork instead?
Well, I mean, not to to diminish what the legislature did here, but it does. It's a modest reform. All it says here is, when you submit an application to rezone some land to develop a piece of property to build more housing in an area that's already designated for growth, the government has to make a decision on that permit within a certain period of time. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it actually means a whole lot for developers, and it will mean lower housing costs as developments start to be built under this new model, where there's actually a time limit on how long the government can take to process your application.
And the time limit is now 120 days. Can you give my audience an idea of what it was before this, or what it currently is?
Well, open-ended, really. I mean, there was no shot clock running. And so that's why it's a significant change that you've got. Now you have this limit on the amount of time the government can take to review these certain types of development applications. You know, some states have gone beyond that. They've said 60 days or even 30 days. And they've applied it to more types of development permits. But this is a great first step in Oregon to open up some more housing and have some more predictability in housing. If you're a developer and you want to build a new neighborhood, that's a huge investment, right? It's a huge investment of time and money, and you don't know even if you'll ever get a decision, yes or no. We represent folks who want to develop their property in Oregon, Washington, other states, where they submit an application and they never get a straight yes or no answer. So that's the other thing this does. Not only does it put a time limit on the decision making, it requires an answer. You have to get a straight answer from the government. And if the government says no, then you get the chance to go to court and you should have said yes.
I guess when I see Kotek do something right, I want to give her credit for that, but let me throw one wrinkle into it and you tell me if I'm off base. So you get an answer 120 days in, they say, yep, Lars, go ahead, build the houses you want to build in that area. We've already zoned it for development. You've asked to build a bunch of houses or a bunch of apartment buildings. Can this be submitted to LUBA, the Land Use Board of Appeals, and delayed that way instead?
Well, there is still some ability to appeal these decisions, certainly. So it doesn't eliminate all of the procedural hurdles that you're going to have to go through to develop property in Oregon, but it provides more certainty about how long that process is going to take, and it gives developers a better idea of how much time and money they're going to have to invest to get a project off the ground.
I mean,
so
because
it's not a grand slam by any means.
No,
but it's definitely a at least a base hit.
And I guess what it makes me want to ask is, why didn't they do this a long time ago? I mean, in other words, almost every other part of the process of government in America has timelines on it. Statutes of limitations. We have limitations, you know, on filing court appeals. We have limitations on filing a civil lawsuit. We have all kinds of limitations. And if you miss the deadline by one day, then you're just out of luck. And yet the government never says, seems to put time limits on its own behavior, saying, well, we'll do it when we get around to it. And then that seems to be good enough for them. This is good to actually set a 120-day time limit and say, you've got to give them a decision, yes or no.
Yeah, well, it's taken a crisis to get bipartisan support for this idea that we need more housing. We're between 3 and 7 million units short in this country, depending on the estimate.
Wow.
That's including all of the units that are being built right now. We're still running at a deficit on housing because basically we stopped building housing around the 2008 financial crisis, and we still have not recovered from that in terms of rebuilding the housing stock. And all of these problems in the development process that were just slowing things down before have now become a crisis because the housing market declined in the early 2000s. And we're trying to recover from that. All of these problems that have always been there have become acute, and everyone finally realizes, hey, if you want more affordable housing, you need to build more housing. And it's taken us, you know, this almost 20 years to figure that out since the financial crisis. And finally, we're seeing the policy results of that consensus.
Okay. Are there other things that, as the policy chief at Pacific Legal, you could see that need to be done to really get the housing market caught up?
There are all sorts of good things you can do to increase the supply of housing. You can, you know, reduce lot sizes. You can have more dense development. Those tend to be a little more controversial, and we support them. We think they're good. We think that's an expression of individual property rights. But there are also things that you can do that we've suggested that to just make the process work better. For example, having a shot clock running on development applications. You can also require that if you submit an application for a development that meets all of the zoning requirements, it's approved. There aren't any discretionary.
You get a presumptive approval, you know, where they just say if you build within these parameters, you want to build a house like that? Okay, that one's on the approved list, presumptive approved, right?
Exactly. You shouldn't have to go through a whole bureaucratic process if what you're proposing is laid out in the code as this is what we want to be built here. You can also limit lawsuits once the government has said, yes, you can build this, and you kind of refer to this with the appeals board. Once the government says, yes, you can build, you know, that involves a long process. Even with this shot clock in place, it's a long public process. Once the government says you can build, you shouldn't be able to just have someone else come in and file a lawsuit to stop that development. If it's somebody that's genuinely hurt by the development, they should have an opportunity to make that claim in court. But oftentimes you get NIMBYs that come in from outside of the community who just don't want to see more development.
Jim, thank you very much. That's Jim Manley, who's state policy chief at Pacific Legal.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
This is
He's up before you are, weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk, as we have talked a number of times over the recent years, about the single most expensive public works project going on anywhere in the Pacific Northwest, and that is the Interstate Bridge replacement, which I am convinced is a dead project walking. I think the thing is already functionally gone. It is not going to be funded. It is not going to be built. And I've made that clear before, just so you understand, as we talk about the details like this one, one of the impacts that's going to happen when, if and when the interstate bridge is ever replaced, what is it going to do to everything around it, including historic buildings and structures that are going to be bulldozed to make way for this project? I have to parenthetically just say, I don't think it's going to happen anyway, because I don't think the federal government is going to fund it. I don't think the state of Oregon has the money for it. I don't think Olympia and the state of Washington has the money for it. I think it doesn't have Coast Guard approval. There are about 100 different reasons why this project won't happen. But if it does, what is it going to do to the things around it? And John Lee, state representative, retired airline pilot, and a reporter for Clark County Today, is with me now. John, you've discovered that a lot of the folks pushing this project are somewhat hiding under a bushel basket the news that it's going to wipe out a whole bunch of Northwest history. Am I wrong?
Not. You're spot on, my friend. And apparently there is a National Historic Preservation Act that requires the Interstate Bridge Project to allow public comment on impacts to historic properties. And so that opened about a month ago. It closes on June 8th. And so I started digging in, trying to figure out details on what properties are going to be impacted. And as you said, they're difficult, if not almost impossible, to find. And so the project website and their press release talked about four historic properties that'll be subject to complete destruction. And that includes both current bridges as well as some harbor shops and water towers on Hayden Island in Portland. But then there are partial destruction properties both on Hayden Island, but most importantly to Fort Vancouver, our historic fort that was created about 1824 with Fort Vancouver, as well as I found another one that our academy, and it was started in 1873 by a church, Mother Joseph of the Sacred Heart, built this orphanage and later a school, and the website shows that it's a WA 150. Well, when you click on it, when you try to do a search, they have zero description of what WA 150 is, but the location of it is the academy, this cherished former orphanage that we love. It's a part of Vancouver's history, and none of this is being made a lot public for people to talk about. And so we wrote an article about it to alert citizens, and I appreciate your opportunity to highlight this just so that the people can understand some of these properties may be at risk of total demolition or negative impacts, partial destruction. We really don't know.
Well, in fact, I want you to talk about the real numbers that you've mentioned to me. And that is, you mentioned publicly they're saying, yeah, it's gonna destroy four historic buildings. The two existing bridges that were built over 100 years ago, and some water towers and a few things like that. How many is the number of totally destroyed properties that are counted as, you know, as the, in the path of the interstate bridge?
So my understanding, and again, this is their lack of transparency, is that 45 full parcels will be destroyed, with another 131 parcels subject to either full or partial destruction. And in that, they said there were 43 single-family residences, 35 commercial businesses, as well as other public facilities. And bottom line is, we just don't know exactly from this alleged transparent organization what is or isn't at risk. I found, and in fact, the Hayden Island residents are hugely concerned about the impact of this. They made a public records request. They asked for visualizations. Where is this bridge and what are you going to take? What's it going to look like and all that? And they got nothing back from the IBR. They were refused. And you and I know with computer CAD programs, You can generate a visualization in a couple of minutes.
Yep.
And yet they refuse to have their staff do this. And so this alleged transparent organization is anything but, and they're keeping people in the dark.
Well, and in fact, did you, when you went through these almost 700 pages of documents describing what the Interstate Bridge replacement was going to wipe out, did you see sort of a concerted effort to hide this? Because they seem to communicate very well on all the other things they want to push out to the public. Oh, it's going to be great for bikes. It's going to be great for peds. You're going to have a light rail. You're going to have all these things. The selling points are given high profile, but the destructive points are buried.
Yeah, they bury you in BS, to put it politely, with hundreds if not thousands of pages of documents, and they say, oh, you can find it, it's on the website. And yet when I type in certain search parameters on the website, it comes up with nothing, or you might come up with hundreds of different documents. They just don't make it easy to find out what is or isn't at risk. And again, the people absolutely have the right to know, to understand what is or isn't being discussed here.
Okay, now, the Vancouver Public Library was not built that many years ago, was it?
No, it's not. And they're right there, right next to where they say the light rail line is going to end. And the one map that was in one of the documents I came across shows the parking lot for the Vancouver Library disappearing. Oh, well, then where are the citizens going to park when they attempt to visit their library? You don't know, other than a couple years ago, the city of Vancouver bought a vacant lot just south of the library, allegedly for a possible parking structure. And the IBR is considering that as one of two or maybe three different structures for possible park and rides. But again, there are no transparency on this. There's no hint. Will the IBR be reimbursing the city of Vancouver for this, or will the city of Vancouver be paying for all of that? And again, all of this ought to be upfront and transparent for the people so they know what is or isn't being discussed and proposed here.
It's funny, too. And the Hurley building that's about a decade old, only about 10 years old, rather tall building, very visible. It's got the name right on it. That thing is gone?
Yeah, that's the site of the proposed waterfront transit stop that's going to be roughly 80 to 90 feet in the air.
Wonderful. Standing there 80 or 90 feet in the air in the wintertime, in the wind, in the rain, it ought to be a fun ride on mass transit. If light rail ever becomes reality over the Interstate Bridge at $1 billion a mile. John, thanks so much for your work, and thanks for the story you published in Clark County Today. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. Lars Larson Show. On demand, wherever and whenever you want it. Get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails on a conspiracy theory Thursday. Actually, we've got one supplied by my friend Josh Marquis, the former DA, now member of the board of the Oregon Criminal Justice Truth Project, and we're going to call out the folks I call the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper. That is the major newspapers. I also apply that appellation to folks at the Seattle Times when they behave that way, but in this case, it's Oregon Live and Therese Bottomley, who seem to have some rather screwed up priorities because, well, I'll let Josh get into it because there are some real comparisons here. But Josh, welcome, and tell my audience, why is it that Therese Bottomley and the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper are so concerned about knowing all the dirty details of an NBA player's divorce, but they don't seem to be concerned about knowing the real facts about everyday criminals who number in the hundreds or thousands?
Exactly. So every week, Bottomley, who's about to retire, next month, or as some people might say, wants to be out before everybody shuts out the lights on the Oregonian, something that I take no particular pleasure in. And she wrote this long piece last Sunday, bemoaning the fact that reporters for the Oregonian, and I didn't know there were that many anymore, were unable to get into a hearing on the divorce of one of the former trailblazers. And it's not tremendously uncommon in divorces, particularly for people who are famous and have a lot of money, for them to file documents under seal. They want to keep their privacy. They don't want people to know the details of their finances. Frankly, although I'm a big First Amendment person, you know, what happens between two people in their marriage is much less of concern. And the reason that I'm so fired up about this and find the hypocrisy incredible is that the Oregonian has, in the last 3-4 years at least, has stood by while the Oregon legislature, the Democratic legislature, as you pointed out, has routinely been erasing criminal record after criminal record. Now, most people would agree that somebody who messes up and gets a shoplifting when they're 19, or maybe even joyrides in a car when they're 22, should be able to get that erased off their record if they spend, say, 3 years behaving themselves. But, oh no, Oregon is now the worst state in the country in terms of truth in sentencing. You can get 5-10 felony convictions wiped off your record. In fact, the only thing you can't wipe off your record now is essentially murder, manslaughter, and Measure 11 sexual crimes. So everything else, when I say expunged, I mean no evidence of it exists. So if somebody is applying to be a teacher, a police officer, a position of great trust, have you ever been convicted of a felony? They can say no, and there's no way for you to check on it.
And the Oregonian didn't object to that at all, even though that very much has to do, number one, there's not much practical use with, say, an NBA player's divorce details. It may be salacious, but it's not a much practical
use. The public interest is de minimis, right.
But if you're running a daycare and you're thinking of hiring a young man or woman, and you say, well, I need to do a criminal check, and they do a background check, and they find out you have no convictions, when in fact you do have convictions, but they are from a time ago, you know, maybe 4 years ago, that all of a sudden that secret, that has practical application to everybody who might do a business deal. They might, you know, buy a product or service from somebody who had convictions for financial fraud. They might hire somebody to be a bookkeeper who's been convicted of embezzlement. They might hire a daycare worker who has either violence problems or sexual crimes that they have committed. And all of that is kept secret. And Therese Bottomley had no problem with that. But all of a sudden, if they can't report on all the salacious details of, I can't remember the ball player's name, but you know, he got divorced.
I think it was one of the Stoudemires, but I'm not sure.
No, I think it was the guy they called Dame. But in any case, they don't have any objection to that at all. And you're right. It doesn't make any sense, does it?
Well, the collateral results are really staggering because, you know, sure, they'll say, okay, well, rapists can't get their record expunged, which is true. But what about the much more common things? As we have an aging population, people hire caregivers to look after, their parents or their children at the other age of life. Wouldn't you want to know if that person, for example, has stolen repeatedly? I had this problem 5 years ago, when I was still district attorney. We would encounter embezzlers who had embezzled thousands and thousands of dollars and had gotten away with it, not just once, but twice before over the cycle of 5 or 10 years, and gotten the things completely wiped out. And you say, well, wait a minute, how did this person come into a position of trust like that?
Josh, let me ask you a detailed question because I want to alert people. If somebody is arrested for rape, in some cases, they will be tried and either found guilty or not guilty of rape. Is it also the case that a number of people who might have been accused of rape originally, the DA realizes, I don't have a rock solid case, but I will accept a plea for something lesser? Does that happen?
All the time. Yeah.
Okay, so does it happen, say, even the majority of the time, since about 90% of criminal cases are plea bargained, so you get an
95%
absolute... 95% are plea bargained. Does that mean that maybe more than 50% of rapes don't show up as rapes in the record anyway?
I'm sure it does.
Okay, hold on. Josh, hold on. Follow me through then. So if the judge is asked, hey, I'd like to have my record expunged, and they look at the record and it says, what would be the one you drop to from rape?
Say, to felony assault.
Assault. And they say, can I get that expunged? Can you?
Yes, in Oregon okay. You can now.
So in other words, it may be, in fact, a rapist who agreed to a plea deal to plead guilty to felony assault instead of rape, and then in 3 years, he can get that wiped off his record.
Absolutely. I mean, with embezzlers, it's even worse because they can be now convicted of, you know, huge levels of embezzlement. And we know that these people go back and do it again and again, and they destroy communities. They destroy people's trust. They destroy businesses. You know, it's just for a state that claims to be about transparency, this is the opposite. And it's really alarming that nobody is sort of raising the call and saying, what are we doing? What about, you know, and again, we're not talking about, you know, making somebody live with a, you know, an adolescent mistake for the rest of their life. There are easy ways to get that wiped off your record. And there always have.
By the way, can I throw one of these, you know, these hypocritical situations at you that just happened in the last couple of hours? So a member of your political party, Alex Padilla, who's a U.S. senator, showed up at a press conference today by Homeland Security, screaming and yelling and trying to disrupt the event, and he was removed and arrested by ICE. And you've got all these people, including Chuckie Schumer, you know, from your party, who say, we're horrified. We're shocked. Why, you know, we're just shocked by this. Now, they weren't shocked when rioters were spitting on and assaulting ICE officers in the last couple of days. But one of their own shows up to disrupt a press conference, and he gets arrested because he broke the law. And they're all of a sudden they're expressing shock and dismay. What do you think?
As Chris Rock says, obey the law. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, look, I don't agree with everything the Trump administration does, but he's president now, and he gets to run the federal part of the government. And the way that, you know, I might think even some of the immigration decisions aren't the best ones, but the fact of the matter is the Trump administration is not breaking the law. And these senators ought to have respect for that. If they don't
agree, then what should we make when governors like Ferguson and Kotek have both said in the last 2 days, Donald Trump is breaking the law by calling up the National Guard? Is that true, and are they right?
No. There are ways. I'm not sure if it was actually necessary for him to do it. But no, I mean, we can look back to Eisenhower and Lyndon Johnson when southern states refused to abide by civil rights laws.
That's right. That's Josh Markey, the former DA, member of the board of the Oregon Criminal Justice Truth Project.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Snowflakes, yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
My old buddy J.D. Hayworth, former member of Congress, but he's trying to live down that reputation. He was six terms as congressman from Arizona and a veteran broadcaster as well. J.D., it's been too long.
Lars and Bob, it sure has, pal. I am so glad to be back with you, and I would be remiss if I did not thank you for those scores of occasion where you allowed me to guest host, and I hope you'll keep me in mind as my schedule frees up. So I look forward to that sometime in the near future.
No, we're going to do that more often because, J.D., you've always been a great guest host, and my audience appreciates you. And I don't get nearly as many complaints as I get when I use somebody else. But I want to ask you about something else. You've got,
sure.
I mean, I swear that we could have solved America's prescription drug problem a long, long time ago. I thought Medicare Part D, I can't even remember if you voted on that or not, but I never liked the idea. It was like using a sledgehammer to swat a fly. But now you've got Big Pharma trying to put up roadblocks when it comes to making America healthy again. Tell me about that.
Well, it is incredible. And first of all, what you stated is quite true. Now, I voted for adding that benefit back when I was on Ways and Means, but you may recall in those early days, we had market-based reforms to hold costs down.
Yep.
As soon as the sides flipped, and I went home, which is fine. After all, the house is not a home. Suddenly, the other guys come in, and they always drive it through government. And so that started jacking up the prices. But it's interesting. Let me lay the groundwork, because this is an idea whose time has come. How do I know it? Let's go back to last year. You know all the pundits. An election year, differences are highlighted anyway, but I don't know. I guess the big word last year was polarized.
Yep.
Okay, so the Kaiser Family Foundation does a poll in that polarized election year. Guess what they find? 89% of Republicans, 84% of Democrats, and 78% of independents say Big Pharma is more concerned about profits than anything else. So you get that. You know, Reagan used to say, if you find an 80% issue, go up and put your arm around it. And that's why the president stepped out last night as the Make America Healthy Again report was being issued. Wow. I know we concentrated and RFK fittingly talked about the chronic diseases for kids and how we get healthy again.
Yep.
But this report, they went in, did a little forensic accounting. And guess what they found in the report?
What's that?
That pharmaceuticals, that we call them Big Pharma, and not for nothing, they spent nearly $5 billion billion with a B on lobbying between 1999 and 2018.
Jeez.
And you may have heard RFK Jr. the other day talk about there's a Big Pharma lobbyist for every member of Congress, 435, every U.S. Senator, 100, and all nine justices of the Supreme Court. And then you look at, you talk about grassroots. Well, the green stuff growing is not grassroots. Big Pharma, according to the report, spent another $6 billion setting up 20,000 patient advocacy organizations, kind of like Shell do-gooders, to say, yeah, we think you're doing a great job. But here's the bottom line, Lars, and it hits everybody in the pocketbook. On average, Americans are paying at least three times as much as our old cousins across the Atlantic in the UK or our neighbors to the north in Canada or any of the, quote, modern developed nations. We're paying at least three times more.
Well, let me ask, and it's for the same drug. So, J.D., tell me this. Why do the pharma companies say, we're going to sell this to the UK's socialized medicine or to Canada's socialized medicine at this price, but we're going to charge Americans three times as much? Wouldn't you think the pharma companies say, this is the cost of the drug, and we're not charging Americans more than we charge everybody else on the planet? Why are they willing to do that?
Because they've basically gotten away with it. And early on, when I was there, they were talking about research and development. And they say, look, we're pouring money into research and development. Well, we've checked, in my role, and I'll identify myself as spokesman for the Pharmaceutical Reform Alliance, we've done some checking, and they've only spent about, 17% of their profits on research and development, but they've spent close to $36 billion with a B on marketing directly to consumers. So you got that kind of disparity. You couple that with the lobbying full court press they put on, and the fact is they think they can still win on Capitol Hill, but without the American people. Now,
well,
here's the new wrinkle.
Let's prove them wrong, JD, because we gotta rein in Big Pharma, And we got to tell them, if you're going to charge the Brits $3, then you charge Americans $3. You want to charge Americans $10 for something, then you charge the Brits and the Canadians the same amount of money. That's J.D. Hayworth, former six-term congressman from the state of Arizona. I'm not afraid of social media. Check us out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and all the other social media, and tell Alexa to play the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson.